Chapter 2. The following morning, the McSweeney dispatched a messenger to the Matthew, requesting wine for his guests. The man returned, bringing the skipper, Nicholas Barnes. Barnes had some unwelcome news.
"The wine merchant, Master Birmingham, is most sorry to disoblige your honours," he reported, "but I am to tell you he has sold all his wine, and is preparing to sail."
"What?"
bellowed McSweeney.
"And he, after coming, telling me he had plenty for all comers?"
Barnes shook his head sympathetically.
"It is indeed unfortunate," he agreed. "Master Birmingham was not expecting to sell his cargo so quickly, but what little we have left is needed for the voyage home. The merchant has asked me to convey his deepest apologies."
"Apologies? What use in the devil's name are apologies when I have a house full of guests? Isn't the O'Donnell's son after riding all the way from Donegal to buy wine for his father?"
"So I have learned from your messenger, and Master Birmingham would indeed be grieved to offend the O'Donnell or his son, but he can sell wine to the young man. He bids me say that if Hugh Rowe and his companions would do him the honour of visiting our ship, he would be delighted to entertain them."
McSweeney refused to be calmed.
"The O'Donnell's son will consider your invitation," he told Barnes coldly, "but it is no joke to him to be coming all this way for nothing."
Barnes made another eloquent gesture of apology and took his leave. The McSweeney turned glumly to his guests.
"My sorrow," he said. "I am after offering what I could not supply."
He looked shattered, and Hugh fell for him. To fail in hospitality was the greatest shame a chieftain could suffer.
"Don't be slighting yourself, Donal," he urged. "What journey could be for nothing, and yourself at the end of it?"
The McSweeney only shook his head.
"Ah, you are generous, Hugh Rowe, but I promised you wine, and I have none to give you. I'm ashamed." "Ah, come on, man. How could you know the English merchant was a braggart and a liar?"
His words had little effect. Hugh hated to see his host so mortified. He looked up at his companions. Maybe they could help. Donal Gorm looked as glum as his father, but Owen O'Gallagher's face lit up wickedly.
"Cheer up," he said, "and I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll accept your man's invitation, all three of us. We'll visit his stinking ship and drink up every drop of wine he has left. We'll show that misbegotten son of a soul what it is to offend the McSweeney."
They all laughed. Even McSweeney had to smile.
"And what if he doesn't offer you all he has?" he asked. "How would he be refusing us? And we sitting in his own cabin, and our tongues hanging out with the thirst?"
Owen looked at his companions.
"Well, are you for coming with me?"
"I surely am," said Donal Gorm at once.
"I suppose, and I," agreed Hugh.
The McSweeney looked doubtful.
I don't know. Wasn't the invitation really for Hugh Rowe? And himself a bit young, I'm thinking, to be down in all that wine." I'll not be having much, Donal,"
promised Hugh, alarmed at the thought of spoiling everybody else's fun.
"I'll drink it very slowly, and the others will look after me, won't you?"
"Like hawks," Donal Gorm assured his father.
"And he has to do everything we tell him."
"Well," the McSweeney relented.
"But mind you keep your word now. Bring him home drunk and I'll tan your hides and make belts out of them."
"Rest easy, father," promised Donal.
"We'll have him back sober as a priest."
A local fisherman, one of McSweeney's tenants, rowed them out to the ship in his little curragh that afternoon.
"Horoo! The Matthew!"
bellowed Owen as soon as they were within shouting distance.
"Hugh Rowe O'Donnell has it in his mind to come aboard and sample your hospitality. And with him are the son of the McSweeney and the son of Owen O'Gallagher of Ballyshannon."
The names must have sounded suitably impressive, for as the curragh came alongside, ladders were lowered and the sailors helped the boy to scramble up onto the deck. Nicholas Barnes received them himself.
"It is indeed a privilege," he purred, "to welcome Sir Hugh O'Donnell's son and his friends aboard my ship. Master Birmingham will be honoured to entertain you and he bids me say he has refreshments prepared for you in his cabin."
He turned to lead the way off. As the boys followed him, Hugh glanced around puzzled. However great Master Birmingham's delight in their company, the merchant was clearly not planning to enjoy it for long. The others might not have noticed, too busy dreaming of Spanish wine, no doubt, but to Hugh, it was obvious the vessel was being made ready to sail. There were men everywhere on the deck. Even Barnes seemed preoccupied. As he spoke to his guests, his eyes darted from side to side, checking the activity around him, and every now and again, he was obliged to break off mid-sentence to shout orders at his crew. The sense of urgency made Hugh a little uneasy, though he could not have said why. At the door of Birmingham's cabin, Barnes halted. "Please to enter, your honours," he said, throwing it open, "and make yourself at home." Owen and Donal obeyed the order eagerly, but Hugh hesitated for a moment. Turning, he looked back toward the Fond Peninsula. In the sunshine, the lime-washed walls of Rathmullen Castle stood out sharply, white against the dark green of the surrounding forest. The tops of the trees quivered in a puff of air, and then, above them, an eagle soared, barely moving its wings. Hugh watched it, one hand shading his eyes. It quartered the sky patiently, till some movement down below seemed to catch its eyes. Then it dived deeply into the trees, like a tern plunging into the water. After a moment, it ascended again and beat away towards the west. Hugh followed its flight with envious eyes. Now there was freedom. Would anyone give orders to eagles or tell them how to live their lives? He watched it till it was no more than a speck in the distance, then turned half sad and followed his friends into the cabin. It was gloomy inside after the sunshine. The windows had all been boarded up, as though against a storm. That too was odd, for the water was calm, and the sky blue, almost cloudless. The only source of light was a horn lantern swinging from a beam above the table. Hugh blinked, trying to accustom his eyes to the shadow, and his unease heightened to a mild alarm. There was a wine flagon on the table, and Owen and Donal both had drinks in their hands. But of Birmingham, or his promised feast, there was no sign. He took a step forwards, and then hesitated. The door shut behind him with a solid clunk, bolting out the last kink of natural light. He spun around and heard a key turn in the lock. "Dia!" Frantically, he flung himself at the door, rattling the handle. Nothing happened. He hammered and kicked at the wood, yelling with all his strength, "Let me out! Open the door, you swine! Let me out!" The others stared at him. "What in the devil is on you, Hugo?" asked Owen O'Gallagher. "They're after locking us in!" "What?" They rushed over and added their weight to his own, hurling themselves repeatedly against the door. But the timbers were solid oak. They didn't give an inch. They tried to prise open the windows, but Barnes and Birmingham had been thorough, and those boards had been designed to withstand the fury of Atlantic winds. They were trapped. On the deck outside, the sound of activity rose to a crescendo. There was an ominous creaking noise as the anchor started to come in. The boys listened to it, their hearts cold with fear. "What are they going to do with us?" whispered Hugh. No one answered him. Snatches of conversation echoed in Hugh's mind. "Would you not like to be there yourself? To hear it all with your own ears? And Perrault demanding hostages? I'd be the fool." But wasn't he, though? A blind, trusting fool who had walked, simple as a calf, into the trap laid by Perrault's oily-tongued agents. Oh, how they must be laughing up there on the deck, Barnes and that merchant Birmingham. Anger and frustration boiled up inside him, and he hurled himself again at the door, hammering on the wood, screaming abuse at his captors, till his voice cracked and his knuckles were raw and bleeding. In the end, Owen dragged him away and threw him into his seat with a beaker of wine in his hand.
"Will you shut your gob and get that into you?" he said. "You'll help no one, and you acting like a madman."
Hugh took a long gulp and looked around him more steadily. He felt the ship swing round and begin to make way.
"She's going up the lock," said Donal,
lifting his head and calculating. "She has the full of her sails of wind, and it blowing from the southeast."
"Then we'll be beaten into it all the way to Dublin," said Owen grimly.
He lapsed into silence, and the others retreated to their own gloom. There was nothing really to talk about, and one flagon of wine between the three of them was not enough to dull their misery. For half an hour or so they sat in silence. Then Hugh heard footsteps outside the cabin. The key turned and the door opened. The man standing in the doorway had to be the merchant, John Birmingham. The bland face and pudgy hands suggested money and an easy life. The man's dress was extraordinary, though probably the height of English fashion. A short, trimmed cloak, a heavily embroidered velvet double, and a pair of trunk hose so short that padded that they made him look as though he had crammed his backside into a giant puffball. Hugh stared at him. Despite everything, it was all he could do not to laugh. How did the man ever manage to sit down in such a ridiculous outfit? Birmingham, however, appeared to have no idea how ridiculous he looked. He beamed at his captives, as though delighted with his own treachery.
"So, three fine birds in one nest, and you..."
Here, he looked pointedly at Hugh's red locks.
"You must be O'Donnell's son, the one they call Red Hugh."
He smirked, as though he had accomplished some great feat of deduction. Hugh itched to wipe the smile off his face.
"I'm Hugh Roe O'Donnell," he acknowledged haughtily, "and I demand to be put ashore immediately."
"Ah, do you now?"
The smirk became a positive leer.
"Such pride and arrogance in one so young. But I fear, my young fighting cock, you are no longer in a position to demand anything. You are my prisoner. The Queen herself has commanded..."
"A pox on your queen, and she a howling old hag of a woman. What right has she given orders to the son of O'Donnell?"
"What right?"
Birmingham's face was a study in shock and astonishment.
"How dare you speak so against Her Majesty? How dare you insult your...
He groped for a suitably imposing Irish title.
"Your lawful ordree."
"High King, is it? The devil mend you for a liar. I have no High King."
"Of course you have. The Queen's Grace is..."
"Is nothing to me. O'Donnell is my chieftain. I serve no other. I spit on your English Queen."
And he demonstrated.
"You filthy little animal." The merchant's fat belly quivered with rage. He lunged forward, and Hugh, snatching up the wine flagon, flung it at his head. It caught the man flush on the nose. He staggered backwards, his hands clutching to his face, and before he could recover, Hugh dived through the doorway and made a wild dash for the side of the ship.
It was madness, he knew it. The deck was high, and they were long from shore. If he didn't break his neck, he'd probably drown. But better that than... He should have realized, of course. He should have guessed Birmingham would not come unattended. There were half a dozen men outside the door, and though his charge took them by surprise, he was not halfway across the deck before they caught him. He kicked and fought and scratched like a cornered fox, but they dragged him back to the cabin and threw him down, held him on his knees at Birmingham's feet. Birmingham looked down at him. The merchant's nose was swollen like a piece of bread dough. It dripped blood all down his fancy clothes. He took his belt off, wound the buckle end slowly around his soft white hand.
"You may think yourself of great account here in the North, Master O'Donnell," he said in a choking voice, "but by the masses, we'll teach you some humility in Dublin." And he raised his arm and slashed the belt down across Hugh's face. The leather bit like a branding iron. Hugh gasped and struggled wildly, but his captors twisted his arms behind his back and seized fistfuls of his hair to prevent him from moving. Birmingham raised his arm again. His eyes glittered, little muscles twitching along his jaw, and his tongue slithered over his lips like a fat pink lizard. Hugh watched him helplessly. The arm flicked. The thong sliced down again, searing, slashing over and over, until at last Hugh screamed. Only then did the merchant seem satisfied.
"And that is only the start," he warned, reclasping the buckle around his paunch. "Cross me again, and I'll make you wish you were never born."
He barked something in English to his men, and then repeated it in Irish for the benefit of the prisoners.
"Take them below and put them in irons, and if they give you any trouble, thrash them."
They sat in darkness, somewhere in the bowels of the ship. Pain and shock gnawed like rats at Hugh's mind.
"This is only the start," Birmingham had said.
What lay in wait for him in Dublin? Would they torture him? Were the dungeons as black as a rumour reported them to be? Would he spend the rest of his life chained like an animal, in cold and darkness? Oh, God, he thought. He hunched himself into a tight ball, and a small sound escaped his throat. Someone moved in the darkness.
"Hugh," said Donald's voice. "Hugh, are you all right there? The little bit that's left of me."
He tried to make a joke of it, but his voice didn't sound right, even to him.
"Misbegotten Saxon swine," said Owen O'Gallagher.
There was a rattling sound as he struggled with his manacles. Hugh felt a wave of guilt. "It's all my fault," he thought, "for insulting Birmingham, breaking his nose."
"I'm sorry," he said aloud. "It's my dirty temper that's after putting us all down here."
Owen chuckled.
"Ah, but did you see the face on him?" he gloated. "And him bleeding like a stuck pig? Doesn't it do your heart good to be thinking about that?"
He laughed, and Donal with him, but Hugh couldn't even raise a smile. He lifted his cuffed hands to touch his swollen face. What comfort was revenge in a situation like this? It was like a nightmare. Only you woke from nightmares. This horror might go on forever. He might rot and die in a lightless dungeon down below the walls of Dublin Castle. Was this a punishment? He thought of his sins, his pride, his willfulness. "I'm sorry," he wanted to plead. "I didn't mean it. I'll marry the oldest and ugliest daughter Hugh Macferna has. I'll put my foot on the inauguration stone tomorrow. I'll rule all of Ulster for you, and you wishing it. Only please, please make this terrible thing not be happening."
But there was no one to say it to. No one to forgive him. No one to wind back time and let him start again. There was only the darkness, the smell of the hold, and the cold iron around his wrists and ankles. The hours dragged by. Owen and Donal talked listlessly. Hugh sat in silence, fighting back fear and nausea. The Matthew had reached the open sea, and was lifting and dropping with gut-wrenching monotony.
"Owen,"
Hugh asked at last, anything to take his mind off misery.
"Owen, you saw him once. What was he like, this John Perrault?"
"A bull," said Owen grimly. "A great hulking bull, with an ugly face and a temper to match. They say he is old King Harry's illegitimate son, half-brother to the Queen. But it's not the Saxon way to be recognising bastards."
That went very...
"So she sends him over here to keep him out of her way."
"No wonder he's so bad-tempered,"
said Donal, and he laughed, but it was a hollow sound. Hugh shuddered. "Be strong," he told himself.
You are a chieftain's son. But it was hard to be brave in total darkness, without a weapon and in chains, if he had a sword or a knife or anything with which to defend himself. He thought about the stories he had heard of men who had fought without weapons. Bards who had destroyed their enemies with satire, stinging them to death with cruel and biting words. Was such a thing possible? He was no bard, but he had a tongue in his head and he knew how to use it. Comforted a little, he finally fell asleep, but his dreams were witful and he woke feeling more nauseous than ever. The hold was foul. It stank of tar and bilge water and rotting wood. He was sweating, despite the cold. His forehead felt damp and clammy, and he began to yawn uncontrollably.
"I'm hungry," complained Owen suddenly. "Are they going to feed us, do you suppose, on this damn voyage?"
"Hungry?" said Donald's voice incredulously. "Sure, it's a stomach like an old billy goat you must have, O'Gallagher. I couldn't touch food in this moment, and you providing it. What about yourself, you?"
Food. The very thought of it, Hugh's diaphragm fluttered, and his throat muscles went into a spasm.
"Oh, Christa," he gasped,
and he threw up violently.